Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello, friends. I'm Daniel Sherrill, and welcome to the 50th episode of the Memories of a Moonbird podcast. How awesome is that? We have a really special episode for you today, so let's get to it. For more than 30 years, she's been working in conservation to protect shorebirds around the planet. She's not only a biologist and field ornithologist, but she's also the actual scientist who banded B95, the world-famous red knot who was nicknamed Moonbird and whom my entire podcast and website were founded in honor of. Zooming all the way in from Argentina, she was kind enough to share with me the history of the real Moonbird, a look back on her career and her views of the future of the Earth. Her name is Patricia Gonzalez, and it's my honor to welcome on this very special 50th episode of the show, the fabulous woman known around the globe as the mother of Moonbird. Patricia, I have to say, before I even officially welcome you to the show, I think we should tell the listeners how funny it is that we had to postpone the recording because you have parrots outside that are addicted to almonds. Why don't you tell everyone about that?
I live in Patagonia, in the north of Patagonia, where we have burrowing parrots. They are beautiful birds. And every early morning and every sunset, they fly over my home, going to their roosting sites or going to feed. But in my backyard, I have an almond tree that right now is having almonds. So during the day, they like to visit my backyard to steal my almonds. And they are very, very noisy when they land in the tree.
So we had to shush them away and wait for them to go so we could record.
Yes, because otherwise we cannot record. Or perhaps you have to interview the parrots. What do they see? They believe or think about the almonds?
Well, Patricia Gonzalez, welcome to the show, the mother of Moonbird. It is so exciting to talk to you. So how are you?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very excited to as well. Imagine I am in Argentina and you are in the United States.
I know. It's crazy because sometimes we just forget or take for granted that we have all this incredible technology and we can video each other from across the world. It's like when I was growing up and I watched the Jetsons and I used to think, oh man, video calls. It's like, I hope I get that someday. And here we are. So thanks, Zoom. Let's jump right in. You were born in Buenos Aires, correct?
Yes, I born in Buenos Aires. But I am living in Patagonia.
What were you like as a little girl? Were you interested in science back then?
No, not really. I didn't grow up all the time in Buenos Aires because my father, he was working in oil exploration. So I live in very, very small towns, far away of everything. I also live in small cities, and as well, I live in Buenos Aires, the big city.
Okay.
Yes, and this gave me the power of comparison because I could see how a nature, a place with nature looks like, how a place with nature is being modified by the oil exploration. I could see how the big cities are completely different from the sites with complete nature from when I was very, very young.
So you had a real chance to see how conservation is important and nature is important growing up.
Exactly. Without really knowing, I could compare, I could see by myself and experience that. And also to begin to be worried.
Now, your degree is in biology, correct?
Yes.
And when did you specialize as an ornithologist?
Well, I really never specialized in ornithology, but in ecology.
Ah, cool.
I study in the University of Buenos Aires. I did just because I wanted to learn more. I never imagined I could work from the biology in those times. It was the times of our government was the military, the army. And really, I couldn't see a future working on that unless I could be in a lab, perhaps. But really, what I thought is that in the future, the planet will have ecology troubles. And so I wanted to know more about it. So this is what moved me to study biology.
Did you know you wanted to work in biology when you started your college education?
No, because I was working in other things at the same time. I have a very good job. My salary was very high. So when I studied, I was doing in different steps. It was a long time because I was working more than 8 hours per day as well.
Yeah, wow, that's a lot.
Yes, but I was doing just because I wanted. I wanted to learn.
So what's the kind of short version of how you went from working a job that was well-paying and getting your education and then suddenly working in conservation with red knots?
Oh.
Because that's quite a jump.
Yes. I was living in Buenos Aires. I got married. I was working as the secretary, as a big boss in the municipality of Buenos Aires.
Okay.
And I got pregnant. And at that time with my husband, we were dreaming to go to live to a place far away from the city because we really didn't like to live in big cities. And then he got the job in Rio Negro province, which is in the north of Patagonia in Argentina. So we moved when my first son was 6 months old.
Mm.
And I only needed to finish my thesis. Was the only thing. So then I have a daughter in Rio Negro. So during about when they were young, all these things were a bit delayed because this is, for you to have an idea, is 1,200 kilometers from Buenos Aires.
Oh, wow.
Not like the university is just there.
Yeah.
And this is the time when you have to travel in buses, no internet.
Back in the day.
Yeah. And I was living in a small town, and suddenly my husband, he's architect, he moved because his job to the Atlantic shore, to San Antonio Este, which is in the Gulf, San Matias Gulf.
Okay.
So from the river, we moved to the sea.
Oh, wow.
Well, when I moved, I realized it's a bay, a small bay with huge intertidals of more than 9 meters. And discovering up to 7 kilometers. And I, because my studies, I knew, wow, this is a very important ecosystem, very productive, important for the small town, important for wildlife. It's the kind of wetlands that we have to conserve.
Mm.
Nursery for fishes that later you will fish and must be birthed there. So at that time, I got a director to do my thesis in Rio Negro, but he knew about birds, and I knew nothing about birds. I never saw the birds. They were very small. I wanted to work with pumas or foxes or whales or things like that.
Some big mammal.
Very little things. And I thought, oh, wow, it's the only thing I can do to work with that. And it was a project to build a factory, soda ash factory, which is a chemical factory, a project from 40 years old, 40, imagine,
wow.
40 years old, something that, and then I realized, wow, this wetland is in danger. So I arranged to do the study about birds to see if the wetland was important for birds, for shorebirds, birds that live in the shore, marine or shorebirds. And at the beginning, I found nothing. And for the first months, until suddenly they all appear, thousands and thousands of shorebirds. And they are talking to us. They are telling to us how important is this wetland.
Yeah.
So when this start the story of my career in some way, because I thought, oh, I have to do something with this. And what I had to do is try to protect these birds.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I wanted that everybody wanted to come and see the birds because nobody went to the beach. There were no four-wheel drives, and people went to the beach only in summer, and the birds were in fall or spring, and there were no access to the beaches. And I wanted, oh, please, I want to show this. So I start with teenagers and kids at the schools to make campaigns.
And how many years ago was this?
This was in the early 90s.
Okay, so 30 years ago.
So I thought we need to create a natural ireprotectant. Yeah. If we do that, it's not going to be a problem with the sawdust factory. Because the sawdust factory project wanted to release everything into the bay.
Mm.
And they said with the low tide, all the wasters will go to the open sea. And the truth is this never will happen. Something that I was working also with other biologists, working in fishes. And there were no studies in the local currents, but one biologist was studying the ichthyoplankton. These are the very small larvae of fishes.
Yeah.
And he said, well, look, the masses of ichthyoplankton are with the high tide are into the bay. And when the low tide, they move just in the mouth of the bay. And then they go in and out all the time, which means there is not water interchange. And imagine if the huge volumes of the wastes of the sawdust factory we got there will destroy everything.
Yeah, would kill everything.
So I start a long, long visit to everyone.
And how long did the whole process take before you were able to essentially save this area?
Well, I think it's all my life from then to now. But we created the protected area in 93. So about 3 years it took.
Mm.
And the teenagers helped a lot. It was a perfect time. It was the time when the legislative power of the province were working in the natural area protected laws. So I was in touch with these people. And this helped a lot.
That's really something special that 30 years ago, you were able to speak to your government and the legislative powers and get this area preserved, because I don't think that environmental awareness was nearly as strong as it is today. So that's quite an accomplishment.
Yes. And then I thought, oh, wow, that's fine. That's okay. Now I can relax and start to take care of my kids and do whatever I want.
Go work with Puma.
Yes, but this was not the truth at all. Oh, in the same year, the area was declared like international site in the Western Hemisphere Shoreline Reserve Network, which is an international organism, institution, that recognized important places for shorebirds all along the Americas. So that was in some way the beginning. And as I told you, at that time, I wanted that everybody wanted to come and see the big flock of shorebirds.
And wait, how many different types of birds are there? Because it's not just red knots, right? There's a bunch of other birds as well.
Well, it was different in those times than now. Unfortunately, in those times, we have about 20,000 red knots stopping here in their way from the I have to tell you, red knots are shorebirds that migrate in big flocks. They travel from Tierra del Fuego, the tip of the continent where they spent our summer. They travel up to the Arctic of Canada where they breed. But there are other species that do the same, like white ransom pipers or Hudsonian godwits and several others.
Now, I know that doesn't the Arctic tern have the longest migration in the world?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but the Arctic tern is a pelagic bird.
Ah.
It goes flying over the seas, overseas, and they eat fishes along the migration. And it's a complete different system, like these shorebirds.
What is the main aspect of your career today? Is it research or education, or are you still in the field, or is it all of it?
Well, always the engine that moved me was to conservation. So from conservation, I moved into science. I love science. If I didn't have to make conservation, I would do only science. But to do conservation, you need the science.
Yeah. And do you work for the science part, do you work in a lab?
No, mostly, no, only very few in the lab. Mostly I am in the field.
Okay.
Most of my studies are catching the birds, banding, taking measurements, looking at the molt, going to the field to make census, take observation of the birds, about the condition of the plumage, about what we call abdominal profile, which is how an index of how much fat the bear has, and sometimes using devices like geolocators or now with satellite transmitters.
I was going to ask, the technology must be really incredible today for tracking all these animals.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Do you plan on retiring at some point, or are you going to keep doing this until you can't?
I think even if I retire, I will keep working in conservation.
That's cool.
And to do conservation, as I said, you need the science, because you cannot do management, you cannot do education if you don't know what is going on with the birds. And I could see in all these years how everything changed, not only the number of the birds. I could see many other things change.
I'm curious about you being a female scientist. According to UNESCO, less than 30% of researchers worldwide are women. And so what's it been like for you being a woman in what is predominantly a male-dominated field?
Well, my story is a bit different, because I was living in a place like San Antonio Este where nobody was working with birds. And only recently we have a university that is still is not teaching about birds. So I was working with researchers from other countries, mainly Canada, some in the United States and the Netherlands. And especially I worked for many, many years with Dr. Alan Baker from Royal Ontario Museum of Toronto.
Cool.
And also with Tony Spiersma from the Netherlands. They were my mentors, which means I met with them. I met with Tony in a conference in Ecuador. And then I met with Alan in one of the Schwarber expeditions. And then I began to work. So really, I never experienced to have troubles working with other colleagues to compete or to have troubles because I am a woman. However, I have a lot of troubles during my conservation work, a lot, just because I am a woman, especially when I was younger. And in those early years, they said I was red, which means communist.
Oh, wow. So they accused you of being a communist because you wanted to save the environment?
Yes. Then with the years, with the years, I start to work with Inalafken. We have Inalafken, the NGO, where we are all volunteers, and we are mostly women.
That's cool.
And then every time we have to fight or to
protest or
whatever we have to do, usually we have to face men.
Has there ever been violence, or has it just been verbal and, you know?
Sometimes they were violent. Not with me. I mean, you mean violent with wars? Yes, a lot. Not violent.
No, I mean physical violence. Like, did you ever get physically harassed or anything like that?
No, not me. But one of my friends got some paintings on her house, in front of her house, and her car, and things like that. But with the time, these things were changing. So even now, our society is machista.
Yeah.
Perhaps not as much than in another Latin American countries, but we still have that.
Do you think that will change in time?
It is changing. Already is changing.
Oh, good.
Yes, yes. And during all these years, it changed a lot. But it still needs to change more.
Yes, definitely. And worldwide.
Oh, yes.
For
yes.
sure.
There are some places with more complex issues and other places with less complex.
Yeah. Well, Patricia, let's talk about Moonbird for a little bit. Obviously, I was excited to talk with you because my whole show and website are founded on the idea of Moonbird. And I want to give a huge shout out to my girlfriend, Jolene, who gave me the nickname in the first place. She's amazing. I actually call her the next David Attenborough because of her knowledge and passion for animals. And I hope one day she's able to create programs like that for the world. But that's a whole side note. She's very excited, obviously, to hear this episode. You are known worldwide as the mother of Moonbird, B95. And I'd love for you to tell people about how you met him the first time, banding him, and what all that was like.
Well, when the truth is that in 95, I went to my first banding expedition with a system called CanonNet.
CanonNet, okay.
Yes. But the CanonNet is something very big where you need a lot of people to work and very experienced.
So you don't hurt the bird, correct?
Yes, but you don't hurt the bird and you don't hurt the people as well. So it's a system that I really like very much now. But in my first experience, this was in Rio Grande, in Tierra del Fuego, in 95, when I met Dr. Alan Baker. I went there invited by Tony Spiersma, and he said, you have to meet with Alan Baker. He wants to study red knots. And of course, I was living in a place with an important number of red knots going the first stopover. Mm. I didn't tell you, but in San Antonio, about the 25 to the 50% of the population of the red knots that go to Tierra del Fuego stop here.
Oh, cool.
So that's why it was important for me to go there.
And wait, before we continue, I'm just curious, what is the actual total migration path of the red knot? They start in Tierra del Fuego, and then where do they go? Because they end up in Delaware in America, but what is their general path up to the Arctic?
Well, not all the birds do the same, but I will give you a path of most of the birds.
Okay.
Because they like to go in flocks, in big flocks.
How many birds in a flock?
2,000, 3,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, sometimes more. In the past, were a lot more. Mm. Now they are less. So they leave Tierra del Fuego about February, March, and the birds that stop in San Antonio Este, or Bahia de San Antonio, where I live, travel 1,500 kilometers,
wow,
just one way without stopping. And they stay here about 40 days, 30 days, depending on the bird, until they double their mass. Mm. First, they finish molting, the body molting, because in Tierra del Fuego, they have what we call a basic plumage, which is gray. It's not very nice. It's white gray, but then they become redder like chestnut.
Yeah.
So they finish that molt and then they very quickly start to increase their body mass by eating invertebrates like clams or little mussels. And then when they have they arrive here with about 120 grams and they live at about 180 or 220 grams.
Wow.
They fly directly to Venezuela or Guyanas or northern Brazil just in one flight of 6 days nonstop. And to be able to do that.
And how many kilometers is that?
6,000 approximately.
So they do 6,000 kilometers, which for the listeners is about 3,800 miles. They do that in one flight?
Yes, nonstop.
Nonstop. So that's amazing.
I ask you, right? Instead you ask me, how do you think they can do that? How do they sleep? How do they rest?
That is a very good question. How do they? That seems...
So it's something very, very amazing what they do.
Yeah.
For starting, they decrease, before migration, they decrease all the size of their internal digestive organs. The gut, intestines are being decreased.
Wow.
And at the same time, they increase the size of the pectoral muscles because they are going to use it for flying, the size of their heart, and all this roosting.
And how long does that take for them to decrease some organs and increase the heart and pectoral muscles?
Well, about a bit more of 1 week, sometimes.
Wow.
A bit more. So sometimes 2 weeks, depending. Once they are ready to fly, usually they like to have wind assistance. Like, you know, when you go in a bike, if you have the wind assistance, you go
faster, yeah.
But they don't know how would be the wind during the migration. But they do know when they leave. And they think differently. Like, I imagine they say, time to depart. And who goes with me? And they depart in small flocks of about 20, 30, 100, no more.
Okay.
It's not the big flock flying. So once they are flying, they use as fuel, the energy, the fat that they deposit in their abdomen and other parts of their body.
Yeah.
And the proteins that they accumulate in their breast muscles, not only for flying, but also they get the water from the muscles.
Hmm.
And and also a lot of hormones and things that they need for their metabolism.
And they get all that from eating mussels and invertebrates and things like that during their roost.
Yes, it's very important for them to be able to feed. Yeah. So if you don't let them feed or you don't let them roost, their energy budget is being compromised. And when the energy budget is compromised, immune systems decrease and they can get ill or not to survive through the complete cycle until the Arctic. So and how do they sleep? They use this one hemisphere of the brain to sleep while the other is working. And then...
Really?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I would like to be able to do that. So I can just work 24 hours a day and get a lot more done. Half my brain sleeps, half my brain is working.
Imagine. We could have one half of the day working and the other half just to have fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have fun working as well, but...
That's awesome. Okay, so they've roosted and now they've flown 6,000 kilometers. And then when do they... That's in the north of... It's the top of South America.
So we are in the top of South America. What's next? They have a short stop, very short, because all the organs of their digestive system are small. They cannot eat very much.
Okay.
From there, they start their trip up to Delaware Bay. Sometimes they stop in Florida. Sometimes they even could fly to Florida without non-stopping as well, which is 8,000 kilometers. But in about 14 days from San Antonio, they arrive into Delaware Bay. And Delaware Bay is very much important for shorebirds and for many other living animals. Why? Because in May, when they are there, the horseshoe crabs lay their eggs in the edge of the water. It's the breeding time for horseshoe crabs. And the eggs of horseshoe crabs are a fantastic food for shorebirds and the base of many trophic webs, for fishes and a lot of production in the sea as well. So a lot of shorebirds from different species and other birds that are not shorebirds, like gulls and many others, congregate at the time when horseshoe crabs, that are an ancient animal.
Yeah,
it's called an alive fossil.
A living fossil.
Living fossil is, of course, not fossils are not alive, but
yeah, horseshoe crabs are cool.
Oh, I love them! I love them. They are fantastic.
How long are all the birds in Delaware Bay feeding on horseshoe crab eggs?
The horseshoe crab is such a, has the eggs have such great quality. Red knots, for example, don't need very much time to feed on them. They may arrive at 100 grams and double their body mass in 10 days, sometimes in 8 days.
Wow.
So this is incredible. It's very, very fast.
And is that enough food for them to get from Delaware Bay all the way to the Arctic?
And the idea is that they can get the food not only to fly from Delaware Bay to the Arctic. They carry extra food from Delaware Bay to the Arctic. Why?
So they can mate.
Because, well, when they arrive in the Arctic, they don't know how the weather will be. It's very unpredictable. Is the snow melt or not? It's going to be one of the high, terrible Arctic storms? Some they don't know. So they need extra reserves for survival in the first days in case of the storms or in case they still don't have food because still there are snow. And also to begin the change again or the rebuild of their internal organ size, not only digestive systems, but as well the reproductive system.
So they go through two organ changes during this migration every year.
Well, no, they... Every time they go to stopover, they go for these changes.
Wow.
When they arrive with all this, the organs of the digestive system, very small, how to grow up, and then they can feed better. And then before migration, it's all the reduction again, at the time that the muscles, pectoral muscles grow up, et cetera, et cetera.
That's incredible.
What, is amazing. And what happened in Delaware Bay about, well, in the late 90s, early 2000s, because the overfishing of the horseshoe crabs, the food for shorebirds start to decrease. So many red knots, and sure other shorebirds as well, couldn't get body mass they needed for migration and to go to the Arctic. And the birds that decided to migrate, the birds that decided that to go to the Arctic and reproduce there, they got the compromise of their immune system, and their survival and production of young were affected.
And so did this kill a lot of the birds? Did a lot of them die because of this?
Yes, it produced a lot of dying. It was a big decline in the early 2000s because this reason. Imagine we have in Tierra del Fuego more than 60,000 red knots. Now we are having about 10,000.
Oh, wow. And are they still on the decline, or are they coming back up?
The last years, it's like they are stable.
Stable, okay.
Going up. The other thing is that the breeding success is usually not very high. But this year, we already know that they have a good breeding season.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
So when did you meet B95?
Okay. So in that expedition in 95, where I met Dr. Alan Baker, and for first time I was in the cannon netting experience, and I saw the net, and we caught more than 1,000 birds. I thought, oh, wow, this is not for me. That's the first and last time. I never am going to catch birds anymore. We were only 10 people. We have to release a lot of birds. Took a long time, and the birds were okay. But the next day, we couldn't walk. We couldn't walk because it was too cold. We were on our knees releasing the birds. And then we were under the cold, banding the birds. It was really hard. Really, we couldn't walk. But I don't say that because we couldn't walk. I say it because I saw the 1,000, more than 1,000 birds under the net. And I thought, this is not for me, really. But now we use different kind of nets. In that net, all the birds were tangled into the mesh. So we have to take one bird by one. But now we use birds with smaller mesh, so the birds are not tangled. And you release them very quickly, and we do smaller catches with experienced people. It's nothing compared.
So my understanding is, during this expedition, you captured these birds to study them, and then you banded each one individually with a tag number, correct?
Well, in that time, we use what is called a flag. A flag is like a band, a plastic band. Indeed, it's Darbic, the name of the plastic. It's UV resistant. It's like a band with the label.
Right.
A label, but was plain, no inscription. In those times, nobody used inscriptions on the flags. We use one flag. The orange color means that was banded in Argentina. Different countries have different colors.
Okay.
United States, for example, if you band a shorebird in your country, you will add a green flag, light green or dark green. That means United States.
And white orange is Argentina, you said?
Yes. White is Canada, blue is Brazil, and other countries have different codes, colors. And we added two color bands. We didn't have very many choices. because we have to use the bands that I took. Everybody thought there will be bands there, but there were no bands there. Nobody asked. Were assumptions, you know?
Yeah.
Usually you go to a place and use the local bands. But the local people have no bands. So I took bands, and I only have two colors, yellow and black. And black is not very good because the leg of the bird is dark.
Right.
But we used one black and one yellow. So we didn't know who banded B95 in that expedition. But later on, in 2001, we have another expedition in Rio Grande, and we retrieved some birds from 95. And this was the first year that we use inscribed flags. Inscribed flags means we added characters on the flags. The idea is that you can read this flag through the telescope.
Right.
for survival studies, instead to catch birds and read the metal, because we also add a metal band that lasts longer with a unique number.
So there are birds out there that are B94, B93, B102, et cetera, et cetera, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what I did is the following. We have the series A, A01, A02, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have the series B. I used the series B for retraps, for birds that we retrapped. So B90, and I used the last ones,
okay.
90s, B90, 91, and one was B95. And look at this, 95 was the year.
Okay.
But this is one of the very many magic things and stories from B95. B95 is, I always think and say that 95 is because the year was banded. But could be another bird, B96 or 97. But no, it was B95. And why B? Well, because Baker, Dr. Alan Baker, was who started all this work to band dreadnoughts in Tierra del Fuego, and then we continue all along the flyway.
So the B stands for Baker, for the doctor.
It's what I like to say.
Okay.
Yes, but we have this series of inscriptions starting with A and two numbers. And then another.
And so do you have them all the way through Z? Like, do you have, you know, yes, Q92?
Yes, and more. Yes. Yes. So it's really what I will say a synchronicity.
Synchronicity. Got it. So Moonbird, which is B95, is called Moonbird because my understanding, when you guys studied him over the years, you realized that the amount of miles this bird has actually flown is enough to get to the moon. And so he was nicknamed Moonbird, correct?
Yes, but it's more than that.
Ooh, tell me.
Yes. We caught the bird in 2001, and we caught him again in 2007 in Rio Grande, and the birds start to be seen mostly in three places. Rio Grande in Argentina, Tierra del Fuego, Delaware Bay, and coming south in Mingan Archipelago, which is in Quebec. In the north of Quebec.
How do you spell that?
M-I-N-G, I think. G or J, Gonzalez.
G, yeah, G.
A-N.
Mingan, okay. Mingan Archipelago, okay, cool.
Yes, yes. So these are the places where this bear have been seen several times. And I saw the bear several times in different places as the people start to say that the bear was following me. But what happened? He was or is a survivor compared with the other birds that were in decline. The population was declining, so the birds were having an average life of 7 years. And the last time that he was seen, he was at least 22.
Oh, my gosh.
He was 22 years old at least. And during this time of his life, he travels from Tierra del Fuego in the Arctic, goes back once per year, as many times as he did the distance between the Earth and the Moon and the moon. Coming back. Mm.
So the Earth and the Moon and back again.
Yes. But
wow, that's incredible.
But B95 especially was surprising us because he was a survivor when all the other birds could not survive. That was really why he started to inspire people, and everybody wanted to know what happens with B95 and where is B95. Have you seen B95 or not this year? And still many people is asking.
When was the last time you saw B95?
Well, it was some years ago. It was in 2015, in January, in Tierra del Fuego. A researcher, Guy Morrison from Canada, and Luis Venegas, a researcher from Argentina, they saw him. But you know what? The flag was fading, and he lost one of the bands. And we cannot identify anymore. So we really don't know if he's alive or not. And I like him this way, because
it's a mystery for the ages.
I think it's the best could happen, because we can imagine he still is flying through the flyway, yeah. or at least it's the way to fly with the other shorebirds.
Yeah. Now today, do you guys have tags that are that have like RFID chips or other kind of technology so you can actually track the birds live on a satellite?
Yes. With dreadnoughts was more difficult because the shape of the bird and the way to act. But right now, for example, there is a project of Environment Canada. They put some tags on juveniles and some adults in last August in Quebec. And one of them is close to here right now.
Cool.
One juvenile is in Venezuela. It's not going to Tierra del Fuego. Most of the juveniles don't go to Tierra del Fuego in the first years of life. But coming back to B95 is a good father as well. How do we know that? Because we never seen him in the Arctic. In the Arctic, red knots spread out in pairs. They are not anymore in flocks.
So they pair off.
Yes. And male and female can be separated perhaps 2 kilometers from the next pair. And both incubate. But just when the chicks hatch, the female leaves and migrate south. It's a long distance migration. So it's a long migration in the annual cycle. It's not the same like going to Florida only. Has to go to Tierra del Fuego and come back in 1 year. And males stay and raise the chicks. And the chicks can walk very soon after hatching. And they
how long?
They eat how long after hatching?
Yeah, till they can walk.
Oh, very soon. In cool. the first day, second day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they follow the father for the food, looking for the food. The food are insects, and the insects appear just in one peak, in one special moment in the Arctic. It's like explosions of food. So when the chicks hatch and grow up at that time, it will be a good breeding season. Of course, depend on the predators as well.
And so it's clear they make this migration once a year, every year, right?
Yes.
How long does the total migration take from Tierra del Fuego to the Arctic?
Well, in one special bird, for example, could leave Tierra del Fuego. I remember, let's say, first days of March, and they can arrive in the Arctic first days of June.
So 2 or 3 months.
Yes.
And then how long are they in the Arctic before they make the migration back? And I'm trying to figure out how much time they have when they're just living their life in South America, hanging out before they go, all right, time to fly again.
Okay. Well, that depends if the breeding was successful or not. And that's to finish my idea from before. How do we know that B95 was a good father?
Yeah.
Because males that were successful migrate later than females. How much later? About 3 weeks.
Oh.
The incubation is about 3 weeks.
Wow.
Then until fledging is about another 3 weeks. So by middle July, late July, you have females migrating, and later females and the non-successful males. And later on, you will have the successful males like B95. That's how we know, or we assume he was successful because he migrated later.
But do they return with their children or no?
Some juveniles migrate with the adults, but the last ones are going by themselves. Wow. So sometimes they end up everywhere at any place.
So you are the actual person who put the original B95 tag on Moonbird.
Yes. In 2001, I was doing this exchange of flags in the red traps. So I was extracting the old flag. Red traps are the birds that were banded in 95 and that we red traps in 2001, or could be banded in another year as well. So because we were using for first time inscribed flags, and the reason to use inscribed flags was to reduce the number of catches for survival studies and to increase the data of sightings,
sure,
which means to know that birds are alive for the models. I was exchanging that. I was adding this.
But you had no idea when you picked up this little red knot.
No.
And put a little tag that this bird would become famous worldwide. That's crazy.
I never imagined. I think the life of B95 was very linked to my life as well.
That's cool. Now, are there other birds you guys have studied that have lived 22 years or longer that you know of?
Well, last year we discovered another one. Was one bird banded in 98 here in San Antonio Este, but the flag was plain. Was a time when we didn't have inscribed flags. I don't know why, but this bird preserved the flag and the two color bands we had. One person in Panama could photograph the metal band, and then we saw the bird here. So we know because the combination of flag and color bands that was banded in 98. And this bird, I saw as a female. I saw her again this year in San Antonio during the quarantine. I was able to go to the beach and I saw the bird. And in July, it was 22. She was 22 years.
Wow, that's cool.
Yes.
Very cool. Now, my girlfriend nicknamed me Moonbird because I've actually traveled enough in my life around the world that I've traveled enough miles to go to the moon. I'm curious, have you also traveled a lot in your life and have you traveled enough miles to be a Moonbird?
Well, I never made that calculation, really, but you forced me to do this calculation.
Good, good.
So really never wonder about it. And yes, I didn't come back to the Earth from the moon, but I think I traveled enough.
To get there.
To go. Yes, yes.
That's cool.
Yes, I was traveling with the birds along the Americas in different stopovers and also in conferences in different parts of the world and even in Australia and New Zealand. Which is so far away.
Well, that's a far flight right there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was there a few years ago. It's beautiful.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Well, you told me offline that you'd had some magical experiences with B95. I'd love to hear about one or two of them.
Yes, yes. All the time. Even now, all the time, I have a lot of magical experience or synchronicities. Mm. But I really like this one. In 2012, I went to Delaware Bay, as every year I was going in those times. So there we were with the international team in different houses. And I was in one house in the beach, in Reeds Beach, in New Jersey, shore of Delaware Bay. One morning, we decided to go to another shore to do recitings. Recitings means go with your spotting scopes and look for banded birds and record. With Humphrey, another researcher, I was with Alan there, and we were waiting for Humphrey. And Humphrey didn't arrive and was being late. So Alan said, okay, I'm going to get Humphrey because I don't know what is going on. And he didn't answer any phone.
Okay.
And you stay here. He says, it's better. So we decided together. So I stayed at the house in case Humphrey will come to the house. You have to understand that the tide is moving. And when you do the recitings, the birds move with the tide.
Yeah.
So we have to be at the perfect time according with the tide. If you are late, you'll
miss the birds, sure.
Yes, yes. So Alan left, and I look at the beach, and I saw no birds. And I thought, okay, better to go to the first floor. There was a balcony to see if there are at least some birds around, even if they are 10 or 20. So yeah. I went out in the balcony, and in front of me about 2,000 or 2,500 red knots landed in front of me. And I saw, wow, I'm so lucky to be here and to stay here. So I put my scope and I start from one side of the flock. And with the scope, I'm looking bird by bird, banded and non-banded. And almost the first bird I saw was B95. I start by the left, and when I saw B95, I felt like a big, big, heavy load on my shoulders, like having the responsibility of all the continent to get a picture, because I knew how many people would love to not only to know that B95 is there, would love to see B95. I am not a photographer. I only had a little camera to do this scoping. I was fall, and the birds are walking very fast.
Yeah,
on the horseshoe crab eggs, eating one, and sometimes disappear in the middle of other birds. So I was moving the scope with the camera, trying to photograph.
So you had the camera looking through the little telescope?
And moving with the other, yes, yes.
Oh, wow.
And moving the scope with the camera pointing, and then leaving the scope, making focus. It's something that I always do. So I have some experience, but it's very difficult. Even.
It is very difficult. I'm a photographer. That's very difficult. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, yes. And I thought, oh, I am alone. Why? I need help for this. And I need photographer. There was a lot of people with good cameras in Delaware Bay, the best cameras. Suddenly, Alan Humphrey and more people arrive. And I said, hey, come here. B95 is here. Please help me to find out. And they start to find out, and we start to do reciting. And none of them could find it. So nobody saw B95 but me. And then I look at my...
Did you get a picture?
I got a picture. I got some few. Not the best one, but you could read the flag saying B95.
Cool.
And the next thing happening that day was in the afternoon, a journalist from New York Times called me.
They wanted your picture?
No, he didn't ask for my picture. But he wanted the story for a blog in New York Times. And he called me several times during the day. And I had to work in different beaches. So it was difficult for me to answer the phone.
Yeah.
It was important to talk to him. And so I gave all the news, all the experience. And he published in the blog the story about B95. And the next thing happening was that later on, the BBC Mundo in Spanish, they publish as well. And you know what? Without my knowledge, well, many others, journals in Delaware Bay or United States publish the news with the picture.
You went viral, basically, right?
Something like that.
That's cool.
And the next thing happening was that my picture was published in The Guardian in UK. Was chosen like one of the, every week they select several pictures of the world, like the pictures of the week.
Yeah.
And they selected my picture. And imagine, I was not a photographer, but of course I could get a picture in this situation. And from that time, all the media in Argentina, the biggest media, the TV, and everything started to talk about B95. And then the world knew about B95.
That's cool.
So when I was traveling to Delaware Bay, in that trip, I was reading a book. And the book talked about synchronicities. Mm-hmm. And the first thing happening was this about B95. How? So that's why I think this was a kind of magical thing. And after that, I saw B95 several times. And then there were many synchronicities. Like, for example, there are theater plays about B95. There are, in Tierra del Fuego, is a beer place called B95. In Mexico, it was a play called Ramiro, the bird that flew to the moon.
Oh.
And it's a story of B95. The day that was the opening, the author and the director of this theater play for family found in the street a bun. And the bun has pictures of red knots in the last windows. And one says B95.
How cool.
And a lot of things like that. I have really a lot of stories. So I think B95 also is a magical bird. But especially the message that live to the people, because it's called the bird of the hope, is showing that we don't have the limits. We really don't have limits. The limits are only in our mind.
That's beautiful. I love it. I really love it. I'm very curious. Did you get to hold B95 after 2012 when you guys, did you actually net him again or no?
No, the last time I hold B95 was in 2007.
But you've seen him ever since.
Yes.
So.
Yes. That's cool. I saw him in different plumages. In the white gray, in the red one, in different moltings. Mm. I saw how the bands were changing, fading. I exchanged some bands to give an individual combination as well in case we couldn't read the flyer.
Mm, that's cool. Well, I'm curious, speaking of all the conservation work and the environment, what today is your main priority as a scientist and as a conservationist?
I think I keep my priorities on the research. Of course, my strength is about shorebirds, but at this time of my age, I realized that perhaps the most important thing I can do is to inspire others. And indeed, short time ago, I was asking to give a lecture in the first symposium of wildlife in Peru for the University of Arequipa.
Cool.
And what they asked me was they really wanted me to try to inspire women, the young students,
yes,
the young students of that part of Peru, that many of them come from the mountains. So I realized that I gave many talks during the pandemic, many talks.
Over Zoom like this?
Yes. And what people is saying to me most of the time is to inspire young people.
Especially women?
Especially women is what they ask me, but also to inspire any kind of people.
Yeah.
Something that you don't know. But with the time, I realized the difference between be just a researcher far away of the people and a researcher that communicate with the people.
Hmm.
In long time ago, one of my friends made a study about that here, a local study, trying to figure out about the communication between researchers and people. And she found that researchers with commitment that show that really do the research and conservation with commitment are the ones that reach the people.
Mm.
The others are being ignored.
Well, I mean, that makes sense that the scientists who communicate to the people have the best results, you know?
You can have other researchers that, of course, write the papers and they need that other people will communicate that to the people. But it's so good having a researcher that himself or herself do the communication to the community.
To the people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see it's the personal touch, you know, that's important.
Yes, well, this is what she found. And after so many years that she did that study, I think that now it's like, I'm thinking, you know, who's next? So inspiration is needed.
You want to influence other people, young people, to take over the mantle, as they say.
Something
right?
like and that. Carry on. I think I was always helping. I work with people all the time, with young people. Mm. I work with rangers every day right now. I work with students in many places of the continent. I help them. Mm. I did this for many, many years. I will keep doing forever, I think.
That's awesome. Does Argentina support science or is it a challenge to be a scientist in your country?
It's a challenge, but depends on the government that is in turn. I mean, we change governments. With some governments, yeah, there are better chances than with others. In my personal case, because I am not in a national system, the money for my research always came from another country's projects that born here, but presented to another places.
Do you think that the human race is going to survive and that the future is bright? Or are you concerned that with all the environmental stuff going on that we're headed for disaster?
You know, this is something usually I never talk about.
But No,
I will give you my answer, what I believe. When I was a student at the university, I thought ecology will be needed at the future. But really, I thought I never will work on that. I thought I will keep working in an office. I never imagined the life will give me this opportunity. But I already have the view in those times that the planet would be in trouble. And now my view is that the planet would be in more troubles despite whatever we are doing. I think the awareness of the people is growing up. But I also know that to learn, people need to face contrast. In other words, you know the fire is dangerous when you get burned. Mm-hmm. Thus, we are being burning every day in many ways. Many scientists are telling this to everyone, to the world, all the time. But not all want to hear this. Not all the government wants to hear this. What I think is going to happen is that we are going to have a decrease in the number of inhabitants of the planet because different issues are going to happen, like the climate change or wars, or we are spending more resources than we have already. So we cannot keep growing up in numbers of inhabitants. It's impossible. Mm. It's not sustainable. So things are going to happen that will decrease human population in size, but at the same time...
When you say things, like, do you mean... food chain being affected?
All kinds of things. Illness, like the pandemia, floodings, poverty, wars.
So in essence, you think it's going to get worse before it gets better?
Yes, but I think is the way to go, because the way that humanity is learning is by contrast.
Interesting.
Is what I think. I might be wrong. I hope I am wrong.
I hope you're wrong too. Patricia, what is the most important thing that people who listen to this podcast, what is the most important thing you want them to know?
I really think that the most important thing, I just said something, but now I come back to the words of B95 or the message of B95 or message of Moonbird. What I just said is a kind of limit. And it's hope. Hope in which way? The limits are really in our mind. What I just said is in my mind. Mm-hmm. But the real limits, we don't have the limits. It's an invention.
I love the message of hope. Moonbird's hope. Mine and the birds and yours. I'd love to ask you a few personal questions. I'm just curious, did you have a favorite childhood book?
Encyclopedia. Encyclopedia for school? Mm-hmm. I love it. I was
That's
reading,
awesome.
And I remember one day I read about the forests, that forests were disappearing, and I thought, but humanity can't be so crazy to make forests disappearing, because we will disappear. And I was 10 years old, and I always remember that.
What do you do with your spare time? What are your hobbies?
I love dancing.
That's great. What kind of dance?
Any dance that I can dance with other people. I was learning bachata recently.
I don't know that.
They are Central American rhythm.
Cool.
But I really love dancing. I love to look at the sky, the stars. And I don't know very much, but I love to put the scope or just be in the nature, sharing with somebody I love.
I'm curious, do you believe in God?
I think the kind of God I believe is not the God that people think is I am here and God is there. I believe that we all are part of the same essence. So I think you are God. I am God. My cat is God. Plants are God. We are all part of that, and we are connected. We are connected from the spiritual point of view, and we can connect our energy. We can communicate through that energy with each other, with the animals, with the plants. And well, I did have several experiences, so that may sound crazy. That's why I also think that science is fantastic, that science is something, is almost like a play with, like a game with protocols, but that still there are some parts of science here is not touching, and one day this part or those parts are going to join each other. And I talk in, I don't know how to call, but about these other connections, invisible connections.
I agree, we're all connected. I really love that idea. And I've always felt that there's a profound interconnectedness to all of nature and all of life on Earth. I think it's very important. And I feel that if people would understand that better, they would treat the environment better and take it more seriously. And I think we so hopefully that's coming. Hopefully the awareness of that I think all of life on Earth is one big organism. And I don't think people...
Yes, Gaia.
Gaia, yeah, there you go, yeah. Well, I'm curious if you could continue to live a very healthy life. How long would you like to live?
Well, as long as my body... let me walk, my mind let me think.
So no particular number, just as long as you're still with it.
Yes, if I have physical troubles, I don't think if I want to keep living. But you never know, perhaps I will discover something new.
Yeah. Do you believe in love?
Yes, of course, very much. I think the love is very, very important, very much important. As much important that love can make change everything, because with love you look at the other person you have in front of you. With love you see the other being that is in front of you, even if it is an insect. Hmm. And you can understand the interconnections between all of us.
Yes.
That make you understand that we are all one. And I really think the love is the one that can help you not to discriminate others and to understand or accept others. I think the love is so powerful. Well, the love is really important. I really believe that. I think it's one of the most powerful strengths. Even I think that when there are no love, it's because the person that expressed that is because it's having no love for them, for himself or herself.
And I think only through love will we find the answers we're all seeking.
Yes.
Patricia, what do you think is the purpose of art?
Well, when I was young, I thought the art was just fun or for free time. But now I think, and I strongly believe that the art is something very much important in our lives, in the life of everyone, in the life of the planet. Because through the art, you reach emotions. Through the art, the artist can give messages that never will reach others in another way. Information is not what you have to give to people. When you want to transmit a message, what you have to keep is emotions. And how do you give emotions? Through the art. It's the only way. It's through the art.
Do you have a spirit animal?
Two animals. One was the horse.
Okay.
The horse can be domestic or it can be wild. But I thought in the horse, not from that point of view, but because for some reason, the horse inspired me freedom. I love freedom. I think the freedom is what moved my life, to be a free woman.
That's wonderful.
And the other animal is the eagle.
Mm.
And I think I feel some identification with the eagle because...
Also a great symbol of freedom.
You are right. Yes. But what I see in the eagle is the view, the eyes, the view.
Yeah.
Because along my life, I follow my views many times, despite many others were telling me you are crazy or why do you spend energy? This is not going to happen. And you know, when you would really follow your heart, so your inner view is not your eyes view, really, it's your inner view. And then my age is telling me that I took the correct decisions instead to hear the fear of the others about what I was doing.
Yeah, I think it's very important to, in life, as they say, follow your heart. And even if other people are against you or they think you shouldn't do something because of their own fears, you should always follow what you believe to be true for yourself.
Exactly. Yes.
And I think you are very much a testament to that. So I applaud you. Well, Patricia, the last thing we do on the show is actually a little game I have, and it's called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with a Moonbird. 299 preguntas. So you get to pick two.
Oh, of course. I know the number. It will be 222. That's my number.
222?
Yes.
Okay. And what about your second one?
Can you see? Need the second one. number two.
Number two?
Yes.
Okay, well, here we go. First, number 222, what's the most useful thing you own?
Has to be something material?
No.
Oh, I will choose my inner heart.
Ah, that's nice. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. That's such a simple answer. It's great. Your inner heart. I love it. And you said number two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What happened? Why are you laughing?
Because the question is, what's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
So a pleasure that make me feel guilty. sleeping. Sometimes, not always. Sometimes.
Well, sleep is necessary.
Yes, but sometimes I like to really sleep more.
There's nothing wrong with that.
And feel guilty.
Patricia, I can't thank you enough for being here and talking to me all about Moonbird.
Well, you know, for me, it was really very nice to meet with you, that you took the name of Moonbird, because Moonbird really is inspiring so many people around the earth. And you are being inspired in another different way. It's like several people are taking Moonbird and making its own Moonbird, a personal Moonbird.
I don't honestly know if I could receive a bigger compliment than what you just said. So thank you so much. I wish you the very best of luck with more conservation and inspiring the next generation of awesome people to go out there and love science and promote science and help heal the world.
Thank you so much. And now you know more about Moonbird.
I do. It's fantastic.
And please send a big hugs and kisses to your girlfriend for inspiring you about Moonbird as well.
I absolutely will. And I really hope someday we get to meet you in person. It's a great excuse to take a trip to Patagonia.
Would be great. Would be very nice. One day, perhaps.
I almost forgot. Happy New Year to you. And of course, please stay safe.
You too. Thank you.
I'm sending you a really big hug through the screen because you're just so awesome.
I got it. A big hug for you, Daniel.
Muchas gracias, mi amiga.
De nada, Daniel. Bye, kisses.
Friends and listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Moonbird and some cool science stuff, check out the show notes for this episode or the page on my website for this episode for links and more cool information all about science. And while you're on the web, if you like this episode, please show your support at patreon.com/moonbird so we can keep bringing you even more great content in 2021. And as always, if you'd like even more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Head on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media at memoriesofamoonbird. Happy New Year, everybody. Stay safe.